Hello, and welcome back to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. I'm your host, Zach Wheeler.
And I'm your other host, Francis Ilya.
And today we'll be discussing a concept in foreign policy known as grand strategy. What is grand strategy? How is it implemented? And does the Donald Trump administration have a grand strategy? To help us answer these questions, to end the podcast, we have two incredibly distinguished guests. Our first guest is Francis J. Gavin. Gavin is a distinguished professor at the Henry A. Kissinger Center for Global Affairs at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. In the past, Professor Gavin has worked in the Nuclear Security Department at MIT and the International Security and Law Center at the University of Texas. Professor Gavin has written multiple books on topics such as nuclear statecraft and international monetary history. Professor Gavin also currently holds positions at the Council on Foreign Relations and the Woodrow Wilson Center.
Our second guest is Professor Hal Brandt. Hal Brandt is a distinguished professor of global affairs at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. He's also the author of several books on topics such as grand strategy and grand strategy in the age of Trump. In 2016, Professor Brandt worked in the Pentagon as the special assistant to the Secretary of Defense for strategic planning. He has also consulted with a range of government offices and agencies in the intelligence and national security communities and served as lead writer for the Commission on the National Defense Strategy for the United States. We really hope you all enjoy this podcast. We had a great time recording it.
Bronze and I this semester are taking an awesome class with these two great professors called the Kissinger Seminar on American Grand Strategy. And today we'll be discussing what is grand strategy and specifically grand strategy in the Trump administration. So to start us off, Franz, do you want to get us going?
Right. So we're very lucky to have you. And let's just start off by saying, what is grand strategy?
Well, so I'll take a crack at that. I like to think of grand strategy as the intellectual architecture of foreign policy. It's what gives coherence and structure to a country's dealings with the world. And so if you have a grand strategy, you're not just reacting to events as they occur. You're not kind of doing things randomly. You have some more considered assessment of what you're trying to achieve and how you're trying to get there. And I think in particular, if you have a grand strategy, you're operating on the basis of a considered assessment of four things. And so one is the international situation, what's happening in the world. Second, what are your country's highest interests or objectives in the world? Third, what are the most important threats to those interests and most important opportunities for advancing them? And fourth, and this is the most important part, how do you use resources that are necessarily finite, they're necessarily limited, to deal with threats and take advantage of opportunities? And if you have a grand strategy, you're not just kind of running these calculations in an academic sense. They're actually driving your day-to-day policies, you know, where you deploy military resources, how you use foreign aid, and so on and so forth. And so I like to think of a grand strategy as a nation's theory of where it's trying to go in the world and how it'll actually get there.
Cool. And so if you don't have a grand strategy, does that kind of look like ad hoc foreign policy, just not really any direction?
So it could look like an ad hoc foreign policy. It could look like a lot of improvisation, or it could just be something where you have contradictory tendencies, right? And so it may be that you don't have a grand strategy because you've never worked out competing views of international affairs and competing views of national interests within your administration, for instance. And so you're getting pulled in multiple contradictory directions.
That's interesting. And so, Professor, what would be an example of grand strategy? Who did it best, or what's just any example of grand strategy?
So before answering that, I just wanted to make the point that Professor Brandt's definition is so important, because one of the things we should mention is there's a lot of people who are skeptical of the concept. In fact, there's a lot of academics and even practitioners who wonder whether the concept exists, whether it's very useful or not, whether it's a sort of an ex post explanation of just how life happens. And so I think Professor Brandt's contribution to this, to actually drill down and say specifically what it is enormously helpful, because the question to ask is, if not grand strategy, then what? Are people just throwing darts at a dartboard? Are they just guessing? And that gets to your question, which is one of the things that we can do is we can compare how different statesmen looked at the world, what different strategies, policies, tools that they use to advance their nation's interests, and compare how they did. And that's obviously one of the things we're doing in the class with you. We can look at examples that worked well. And I think another thing that we can do is to look at it over time, right? Because sometimes you can have the best grand strategy and not ideal outcomes. Sometimes you can luck into good outcomes. And I think what you want to do is to look at the statesmen that embraced the definition that Hal has put out there and best met those categories. And people are going to debate about this. There are some people who are going to say, well, you know, Woodrow Wilson had an amazing grand strategy, and others who would say it's an absolute disaster. Same with Henry Kissinger, the namesake of our center. And so I think evaluating grand strategies is involves both a lot of sort of evaluating what the outcomes and what the process was, but there's also a lot of room for debate in these things, and everyone has their favorites. I mean, we can agree on certain things being worse than others, right? And you know, there's probably some consensus that LBJ's grand strategy towards Vietnam was probably left something to be desired, but then there are others where you say, well, you know, look at what we discussed in class today, Reagan's grand strategy, which right. There's great debate.
Yeah, Franz and I definitely have very different definitions of what we think is great grand strategy.
Right.
But Franz, do you want to get us into the conversation about the Trump administration?
So Politico, I think it was May 1st, released this article basically highlighting the Trump's administration National Security Council, the panic that it was when they were transitioning. With all the new political appointees coming in and how they refer to career statesmen and career policymakers. So, you know, two years into the Trump administration, do you guys see the Trump administration having a grand strategy? And if so, what is it? What is the rudimentary points of it?
So I think one of the reasons that the Trump administration's foreign policy often looks so chaotic or so contradictory is that the administration is being torn by competing tendencies. And so on the one hand, you have the president's worldview, which represents a pretty sharp departure from the post-World War II tradition in American foreign policy. He's anti-free trade. He's anti-alliances. Doesn't care much for the role of democratic values and human rights in American foreign policy. And that really is something new, at least over the past 70 years. On the other hand, a number of the president's close advisors, particularly during the first year and a half of the administration, and then the foreign policy bureaucracy, kind of the permanent government of foreign policy, adheres to a much more traditional approach to foreign policy, one that's basically in keeping with the role that the United States has played in sort of maintaining a relatively open and stable international order over the past 70 years. And so as a result of the clash between these two tendencies, policy gets pulled in different directions. And on some days it looks like the president is asserting his will in U.S. foreign policy, like when he withdraws from the Iran nuclear deal or the Trans-Pacific Partnership or the Paris Accords on climate change. On other days, it looks as though kind of the establishment is winning in the sense that, you know, the United States continues to put more money into Europe to try to beef up the deterrent against Russian aggression and things like that. And so that's why I think there's been a certain incoherence in this administration's foreign policy. And the question is, which of these tendencies is winning out over time? And I happen to think that the Trumpian tendency is winning out over time, in part because the president has a lot of power in foreign affairs and can generally get what he wants so long as he's really willing to apply his influence and his prestige to get it, and in part because the president has been moving out the advisors who disagree with him or see themselves as checks on his behavior and bringing in loyalists in their place.
Right.
Could I add something? Yes, I think the incoherence is not necessarily historically unprecedented. And I think if you look at the first year of the Kennedy administration, the first year of the Reagan administration, the first year of the Clinton administration, any number of administrations. And part of it is for the reasons that Hal mentioned, in that you have this bureaucratic infighting, you have an administration coming together. Part of it is the president themselves usually fight elections over domestic issues, and they haven't had a time really to develop a coherent sense. They often cede much of their authority to their underlings. One of the things that almost every president discovers is that foreign policy is a far more important part of the job than they recognize, and it's also an area where they can leave more of their stamp than in domestic policy, where they often face incredible constraints, not the least of which is Congress. And so I think it's not necessarily unusual, and I think the test of whether there's a Trump grand strategy and whether it's consistent and coherent, we will be seeing in the next 2 years, right? Because I think you've gotten through that point that administrations do, and I think the people that he wants are increasingly in place, and the people who may have had different views are increasingly not there, and I'm sure that the president now recognizes that foreign policy is both pressing and important and never goes away, but it's also a place where you can make more of a mark at time. You can't control necessarily what the Federal Reserve does, no matter what you do, but you can actually shape outcomes in the foreign policy world to an extent that a lot of people when they're running a campaign aren't necessarily thinking about.
Now, are all of these ideas original to Trump, or has he been influenced by a certain foreign policy thinker or someone in his administration? Because from what I can see, even from his start of his campaign in 2015, he's been saying this. Are these ideas original to him, or?
No, these ideas have a relatively long lineage in American history. And for, you know, 150 years after the American founding, sort of a reliance on relatively protectionist trade policies and an aversion to permanent alliances. I mean, these were more the norm than the exception in U.S. foreign policy. And even since World War II, there have been individuals who have critiqued U.S. foreign policy, offering similar critiques that the president has offered. And so the president's view of American foreign policy is sort of a giveaway to American allies and to American adversaries, something that squanders our wealth and power. It's something that would have been very familiar if you looked at the campaign that Pat Buchanan ran for president on in 1992. And so I think what's new is that it's unusual to have somebody who voices all of these views in a package and manages to come out on top in the American political system. Because in previous instances, the American political system kind of filtered out people with these unorthodox views, whether it was Robert Taft in 1952 or George McGovern in 1972 or Pat Buchanan in 1992. But this time around, despite the fact that the president earned the opposition of basically every foreign policy expert on the Republican side of the aisle, he not only won the nomination, but the general election.
Right.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think maybe I'm wrong here, but I think from our readings last year in a course I took U.S. foreign policy, we discussed George W. Bush, his administration before 9/11, like, had been espousing rhetoric that was very realist, sort of similar to Trump's, in that they wanted retrenchment, they wanted to pass the buck to other people. Is that, like, do you see a similarity there, or is that not what the Bush administration did before 9/11? Or
I think that there's a lot of sort of issues to be unpacked in what you said. There's a great controversy over whether what Trump is saying and doing is realism, and how realism's relationship to Trump. There's a lot of realists who say, yes, this is exactly what we mean, and there's others who say there's nothing realistic about this. I think that, to be fair to the Bush 43 administration, what they were reacting to was a sense that in the post-Cold War world of the Clinton administration was engaging in grand strategy based on values that were, you know, humanitarian intervention or making the world a better place, and that perhaps at the cost of pure national interest. Right. And that's not necessarily, I actually think that the Bush administration, even in that more constrained sense, certainly thought alliances were important, certainly thought global engagement was important. It was to what end? Whereas I think the Trump grand strategy looks at the world with some suspicion and just assumes that the world is trying to take advantage of the United States, and actually sees, in some ways, I think what Bush 43 was doing was saying, we internally have to decide what we're doing, but there's no doubt that we should engage the world. It's to what end? I think the Trump administration inverts that and says our engagement with the world is actually problematic because they're taking advantage of us.
Yeah. So one area where there is continuity is that in every post-Cold War presidential election, except for maybe 2004, the winning candidate has been the candidate who said that we were doing too much in the world rather than too little. That's true of Bill Clinton in 1992. In 96, it's true of George W. Bush, who was less of a hawk than Al Gore was in that election, and so on and so forth. And I think what that testifies to is that since the end of the Cold War, American grand strategy has been in search of a persuasive political rationale for why we're out there trying to shape the world right. so assertively. And it's not intuitively obvious to Americans why we should care about what happens in the South China Sea or what happens in the Baltic or Ukraine. It's actually easier to explain that stuff when you have a grand threat.
Right.
And since there hasn't been a grand threat after the end of the Cold War, with the exception perhaps of a couple years after 9/11, and so it's not a coincidence that 2004 is the one exception to this rule that I just mentioned,
right.
It's become harder and harder for American administrations to sort of justify U.S. foreign policy over time.
So my next question I have is, how would you respond to someone who is someone who argues that the Trump administration has had a lot of successes in foreign policy so far? So just naming some things that I've listed here, defeating the ISIS caliphate in Iraq and Syria, creating nuclear negotiations with Kim Jong-un, even though they failed, there's no longer rockets going over Japan, pulling out of the JCPOA, yet Iran is still in the deal, even though we have sanctions on Iran. And even the trade war of China, them maybe giving ground, not totally sure yet. How would you respond to someone who says, look, the Trump administration's been doing a good job?
Maybe I'll take a crack at that, and then I imagine Professor Gavin will have something to say. So I think we could take sort of the nuanced splitting view of this, where I would say that some of these things that you mentioned are either fool's gold, right? And so the negotiations with North Korea, I think, are fool's gold, because I don't think we're actually going to achieve much there. And I'm worried what we'll give away in the process. Some of these things are areas where if the Trump administration gets credit, it only gets credit for continuing things that its predecessor was doing. And so the strategy for defeating ISIS was set in place under the Obama administration. Yeah, the Trump administration should get some credit for rejecting some of the crazier ideas that were mentioned about how to intensify that campaign and basically continuing it. But this was not an innovation. And then there are other areas where I think the Trump administration actually should get some credit. So I think that even though I don't necessarily believe that obsessing about the trade deficit is the right way to think about the U.S.-China relationship,
right.
I do give the Trump administration credit for sort of shaking up that relationship and recognizing in a more explicit way that it's competitive. But what I would say in sort of a broad sense is that none of it's worth it, because the Trump administration has also done a number of things that I think are deeply damaging to U.S. foreign policy, whether that's giving the impression that the United States doesn't care about sort of a positive sum foreign policy and is only interested in its own naked self-interest, right? Or damaging relationships with longstanding allies, or forfeiting the moral high ground in terms of talking about human rights, democracy, depreciating American soft power, and just giving this air of general incompetence and unsteadiness that is really unaffordable if you are the superpower. And so when you put all those things together, I'm afraid that the balance sheet is quite negative.
Yeah, I think with grand strategy, you want to think of longer time horizons. I'm sure the New York Times was all full of praise for the Treaty of Locarno, for the Washington Naval Treaty, for all the sort of...
Look those up.
Yeah, Kellogg-Briand. You know, the 1920s looked like this, and we look back on these as this kind of foolish and disaster. And those are actually were, I think, quite impressive compared to the general overall thrust of the Trump administration. I mean, look, you want to ask yourselves, are the foundations for continued American safety, security, and prosperity over the long term, 10, 20 years, being put in place? And I think about something that we hardly ever talk about, but the Trans-Pacific Partnership, right, which
right.
was something that was designed for geostrategic interests, of recognizing that the geopolitical game had moved to East Asia, that people were concerned about the rise of China, very carefully constructed. There's all sorts of domestic political and economic arguments against it, but just to simply throw it out after a variety of states had gone to great lengths to try to get this through. And it's
right.
This is the same with relations with NATO. Should Germany be spending more on the defense? Of course, absolutely, right? But is this really... If the price of continually denigrating an ally and an alliance is 15, 20 years, the alliance doesn't exist anymore, well, that doesn't benefit the United States. So I think I'm with Professor Brands on this, that of course we should not get all hysterical and not assume that everything's bad. I think the record in a kind of a short-term sense has been better than anyone expected. I will say I live in great fear when the crisis finally comes and how they will respond to it. We have not seen that great sort of challenging crisis that nobody expected or anticipated, which is when the competence of an administration is really tested. And Trump has been bizarrely lucky in some ways. And one cannot expect that to last for 4 years.
Right. Well, you know, some would argue that the United States doesn't do particularly well without an enemy or like someone to point a finger at and base their foreign policy decisions about. So does the United States need an enemy? I'm looking at, you know, China, Iran, you know, a new axis of evil.
Should we go looking for enemies?
Well, it needs an organizing principle, right? It doesn't need an enemy per se, as it needs. I mean, remember what Professor Brands talked about, an intellectual architecture. Part of an intellectual architecture is there's a kind of a reason, an explanation. There's a why you are engaged in the world in the way you are, and it doesn't necessarily have to be adversarial. That can be convenient as an organizing principle. Wilsonianism, which one might argue was a failed grand strategy, but it still had organizing principles that weren't based on adversarial relations. A lot of aspects of thinking about liberal internationalism, whether you agree with it or not, are based on kind of Pareto optimal view of the world, non-zero sum, but that gives purpose to American action in the world, that explains why it is we do what we do and why we pay the cost that we do. Absent that, it is hard to sustain. And this, I think it is one of the things we have struggled to do in the post-war period, is to come up with a long-term, compelling, overarching explanation and conceptual lens to make sense of what we do, as opposed to, as you said earlier, just reacting in ad hoc ways.
Right. Yeah, I think this is right. And I would say, you know, we shouldn't go searching for enemies, but in some ways having an enemy makes things a lot easier, right? It makes things easier intellectually as a way of sort of organizing what you do in the world. It also makes things easier politically, in the sense that it has always been easier to mobilize Americans to provide money, to make sacrifices in the service of some global project when they're doing it in response to some threat. I mean, why did Americans not support the Wilsonian agenda in 1919? Because there were no threats left. There was no reason for Americans to feel like they needed to be out shaping the world. And I think that's one of the reasons why I made the point earlier that we've been living on sort of borrowed political capital since the end of the Cold War, because there hasn't been an enemy to sort of provide the rationale, to provide the foil for American internationalism. And so the good news or the bad news, depending on how you look at it, is we're increasingly getting back into a situation where Americans are defining their foreign policy in opposition to a foreign rival, which is mostly China in this case. And so that can be dangerous in a lot of respects. It can also be constructive if it convinces us to do things that we ought to do, either to shape the international environment or to improve our own system, things that we ought to be doing anyways. If we do them because of the rivalry with China, I think that's actually a helpful dynamic.
Yeah, that's interesting. I have a lot of friends here at Hopkins who would say that our enemy right now, and the reason why we should be operating in the world with other countries and nations, is climate change. It's like, this is this global issue that's going to affect all of us. It really is this national security threat. It's going to change the way the world works, and we can address it without other nations. And I think that's an interesting argument. I just think that's cool. Another kind of line of questioning here is, I'm interested about China. So the trade war of China, a lot of people criticize Trump for creating tariffs that, you know, harm the domestic U.S. economy and, you know, creating rifts between China and the U.S. But the fact of the matter is that China's been doing a lot of things that the U.S. doesn't agree with for a long time. So theft of intellectual property and spying on American, you know, citizens and agencies, etc. Those aren't good. So how do you pressure, I mean, what can we use, how do we pressure China to not do these things that we don't like without, you know,
going to war
or economic sanctions or something like that? Like, what is the move here?
So I think this is one of the areas where the Trump administration has been relatively successful. I mean, I think writ large, most people who understand economics understand the rules of comparative advantage and understand that over the long term, you want to have as much trade as possible. That being said, it's very clear that China has violated a variety of international laws and norms and practices in terms of intellectual property threat, in terms of currency manipulation, in terms of hoarding reserves, in terms of a variety of practices. And the Trump administration deserves some credit for actually calling that out and doing something about it. And I think we're at an interesting inflection point, because the theory behind engaging China in the liberal economic order and involving them in international trade was the hope that over time that both their own self-interest and the power of these norms and these practices would sort of shape their behavior both economically and geopolitically, and it did neither. And so we're at an interesting point, because you can imagine a scenario where you say, all right, you're going to compromise a certain amount. We know that China's not going to completely reform, but they're too important a player. Or you're actually going to put really hard pressure on them now and say, look, you can't expect to derive the benefits of an American-led trade system if you continually violate and flout the rules. And you could have a situation where China says, all right, well, we're gonna reform, we're gonna change, or we're gonna change our own, create our own international economic system that's in parallel. And so this is a really big set of issues right now. And this is something that I think it's unclear what the outcome will be. But the Trump administration deserves credit for putting this on the table, because the drift that was taking place was leading to China taking most advantage of the system without playing by its rules and undermining those parts of it that it didn't see as beneficial.
Let me add one piece of praise and one piece of criticism for the Trump administration. So the piece of praise is that I think the Trump administration has correctly fixated on the idea that unfettered economic integration with China is not necessarily a good thing. And one example of this, there was a report issued by DOD last year, which basically made clear that in virtually all of the munitions that the U.S. military uses, there are components sourced from China. And it doesn't take a Bismarck to realize that that might be a problem in a war over Taiwan. The piece of criticism, though, is that if you are trying to convince China to change its ways economically or to bring pressure to bear on China, you'll be much more effective doing that in a multilateral context. And so while it makes sense maybe to pick a fight with China over its economic practices, it doesn't make sense to pick a fight with our own allies in Europe and the Asia Pacific over their economic practices at the exact same time.
And that's an excellent point. And it brings us to the next important point that we should discuss, is that Europe is not necessarily following the United States' steps here, not in the same manner as they were when the United States was competing against the Soviet Union. In fact, it seems that at times the European Union, the United States, have different goals and different interests regarding China. For example, last week the Trump administration announced that it would curtail intelligence sharing with Germany if Germany goes ahead and buys into Huawei's 5G system. Why are we encountering these challenges between the European Union and the United States when it comes to China, and what will it take for them to find the common ground needed to contain Chinese influence?
I mean, I'll just give a very brief answer, and I know, Frank, you'll probably want to say something about this. One, it's a mistake to sort of mythologize the past of U.S. relations with its allies. And so during the Cold War, there were bitter fights over similar issues. That's right. Whether the Europeans were basically going to help the Soviets prop up their economy by building a pipeline that would allow them to export more energy and things like that. That said, I think there are two or three issues in play that are making the Europeans reluctant to sort of cooperate with the U.S. on the 5G issue. One is that it's just not quite clear what the alternative is, because the Chinese are ahead in 5G technology. And so if you say no to Huawei, who are you saying yes to in the near term? The second is that the Europeans don't necessarily have the same view of the China challenge that the Americans do, just because of geography. And so increasingly, Europeans see China as an economic challenger, as a supporter of authoritarian political norms in a way that Europeans don't necessarily like. But they don't see China as a military threat in the same way that Americans do, because most European countries are not Pacific powers anymore in the way that the United States is. And then finally, I think there's concern about following the United States into a confrontation with China for a couple of reasons. One, because the Trump administration has also picked economic fights with the EU and has made clear that he views the EU actually as more of a competitor than China. And two, because our allies, not just in Europe but also in the Asia Pacific, are worried that the Trump administration might ultimately cut some kind of deal economically or otherwise with China, leaving everyone else in the lurch.
Yeah, this is where effective statecraft would be really useful, and where I think the Trump grand strategy is found lacking. Because for the reasons that Professor Barron's mentions, this is always going to be a hard sell. Europe has a completely different view of China than we do for geography, and they're always reluctant to necessarily go along with this harder line on economic sanctions and the like. That being said, one could imagine deft diplomacy where you were rehabilitating the transatlantic alliance, where you were talking up the value of the EU, where you were cooperating and consulting, where you might get some headway on this. But if you're the EU, why would you possibly have any interest? It's not entirely clear to you that you think the US is trending to be an economic ally. So this is an area where I actually think the Trump administration's instincts are actually probably closer to right, or at least something to consider. But the way they've gone about it is just actually maybe even made it more likely that there'll be problems than a solution.
All right. Well, thank you very much, professors. This has really been a wonderful, wonderful podcast, and hopefully we'll hear from you again.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for listening to the first episode in season 3 of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. Franz and I really thought this was a really cool and interesting interview, and we really want to thank Professor Gavin and Professor Brands. And we want to thank the audience for listening, because we think it's a really important issue and one that's interesting. Just to bring us out here, we always want to remind you guys to follow us on social media. So Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, at Hopkins POFA, at Hopkins POFA. You can find great pictures of Franz doing silly things in the audio studio, Megan doing a dance on Brody Terrace. Who knows? You can find all of this at our social media, and you can ask us questions and give us feedback on the podcast if you like, because we'd love to hear it. And if you see us around campus, you know, hit up, say hi. Exactly. All right, guys, have a lovely week, and we will see you soon.
You will hear from us soon. That's true.